Anyone but me need a drink? I mean... Her eyes scanned down to my upper chest. Sorry. P.I.'s face colored slightly. Roll. Give me the ring, I said. The one Ms. Banks gave you. Roel started, then hastily removed the band. He glanced back over to the laptop on Banks's desk. The USB end is still plugged in. You want that too? It's already done its damage, but yeah, I need the whole thing. Roel moved to the laptop as Kate said, You're going to the hospital, nothing else. Based on the amount of blood that's already come out of you, I'm surprised you're not already dead. Banks is right about one thing anyway. We've got to call 911. Manners wasn't wrong about the blood. Someone who'd lost as much as I had shouldn't be walking and talking. Maybe this printed version of me was tougher than Carter 1.0? Intriguing idea. But even if true, me, 2.0, had shown himself not to be bulletproof. So, someone was in my head. Raoul poked at his temple. Know anything about that, amigo? Yeah, I said. Kate can fill you in with the whole story, but short and sweet. Dark energy is a sea swarming with hungry sharks. When someone switches on a truly quantum computer, it's like dumping a bucket of chum over the side of your inflatable life raft. It's only a matter of time before something hungry swims up. Raoul nodded in recognition. Yeah, that's about right. What an odd reaction. Paldred said, What? That makes no sense. He's jabbering, unless... Raoul punched the scientist. Paldridge stumbled backwards, yelping in surprise. His heels caught a carpet edge. He fell on his butt and glared up at Raoul, rubbing his face, but he shut up. The gray haze thickened across my vision. I was just about out of time. The ring, I croaked. Here, said Raoul. He clicked the two parts of the ring together and pressed it into my palm. I examined it. It was eerily familiar. Like something I'd glimpsed in a dream once, but I couldn't place it. According to Kate Manners, the band had printed to Earth along with Jason's first envoy, which meant it was an artifact of Ardeen. It was made of baryonic matter, but it was entangled with a world beneath the world. That made the ring a sort of golden ticket. Maybe I could use it to try what Jason had just done, but in reverse. I had to stop Jason. And maybe save myself in the bargain. Because me, 2.0, wasn't long for the Earth. I whispered, Kate, Raoul, Paldridge, and Banks, you two. Clean up what Jason put out on the Internet. Scrub it and stop whatever tries to duplicate it. Kate rubbed her eyes. If it's a virus or a worm like the one that took out those uranium enrichment centrifuges in Iran... Idiot, snapped Banks. He's uploaded schematics for how to construct a quantum computer. My schematics. I didn't know if I could convince Liza Banks of the danger she was in. She wasn't interested in absorbing evidence that ran counter to her agenda. People get like that. When they do... They resist changing their minds, too invested in their old ideas, mistaking those ideas as part of themselves. I was too mortally wounded to try to talk her into my way of thinking. So I turned my attention to Kate and Raoul and said, Banks is right about schematics, I'm guessing. The problem isn't merely a traditional computer virus or worm, it's the knowledge the worm contains. Knowing how to improve current quantum processor technology is most of the way to building one. Make sure that knowledge doesn't get out. Banks cocked her head and butted in, asking, You want us to become what, codebusters? My instinctive laugh at the term codebuster became a cough. Banks was obviously not a technical person. When I got my spasming lungs under control, I said, If you care about safeguarding yourselves, your friends, everyone, the whole Earth and everything on it, you'll do what I say. Right, said Banks in a speculative tone. She'd gone from angry to looking vaguely concerned. I'd about run through my strength. Talking was done. Hopefully, they'd do what I said. Ultimately, it wouldn't matter if they found every bit of loose code describing superposition best practices if, in the meantime, Jason brought on Ardeen's apocalypse, collapsing the recursion. Without Ardeen as a buffer, Earth would be exposed to the strange, to the direct connection we'd unwittingly created 3 years ago. So my job was to stop him. I fumbled on the ring. The numbness spread from my stomach, reaching all the way to my fingers and toes. I closed my eyes and pitched back. Hands might have caught me, or maybe not. Cold was the only sensation, except for the tingle of the ring around my finger, hot as a coal. I concentrated on it and let the cold claim everything else. A chasm opened beneath me. I fell into an abyss with sides as sheer as scissor blades. Chapter 15 Suspicion Catherine Manners. Kate watched Carter Morrison disappear. No sci-fi sparkle of lights or musical chord. Just blink, gone. Except for all the blood he'd left behind. That and the ring. She retrieved it without thinking. A spark of static electricity stung her palm, but she didn't let it go. What the fuck had Carter meant about scrubbing out knowledge? He should know it was virtually impossible to remove information from the Internet. When people were wounded and the oxygen to their brain slowed, they got confused. Except now she was the one who was confused. Maybe she'd taken a bullet, too, and hadn't realized it in the excitement. Kate started a visual inspection of her extremities just to be sure.
Mierda, whispered Raoul. Carter can translate. I wouldn't have guessed.
Translate, said Kate. What's that mean?
Raoul pointed at the empty spot where Carter had been.
He can move between recursions by willing it, and so quickly.
Oh, shit. Kate put the ring in her pocket almost absent-mindedly. Now Raoul was going funny, too.
Translate? Recursions? Explain that. Explain how you know that, or am I still talking to Jason?
She leveled the gun at her friend, wondering if any answer out of his mouth could satisfy her. Chapter 16 Deception Elendine, Queen of Azurium. A thick veil of blowing web strands settled across the jungle canopy. Each strand supported a single dark kernel, and each kernel, Elendine knew, would sprout a ravenous prey. The descending masses' leading edge passed overhead, and she, Navarre, and her entire detail came under its shadow.
"We're beneath it,"
screamed the first protector.
"Make her preserve us," breathed Elendine.
Even riding full out, they couldn't escape the crayfall. A few peacemakers tried anyway, spurring their steeds into a confused gallop across the broken plain, away from the plateau. The poor fools were already dead, thought Elendine. Maybe she was too, and all who stood their ground with their queen. Except she wore death. It would suffice or nothing. Elendine raised her fist. On it, her hope flashed. She concentrated on the ring of death, and a response stirred within its dark coil. It flashed like a black star, opening a sliver of its power to her. She flinched as the shade of death brushed past her. But what else had she expected? Elendine called upon the serene stillness of the grave, inflating that quiet until it swept away, up and around her. The descending cray seedlings passed through it, freezing solid. They pattered down around the queen and her host like hail, creating a perfect white circle at their feet. The visage of death stared at Ellendine with its lidless eyes, then faded. Profound tiredness sapped her strength as if she'd just run a mile at full sprint.
"Crush them!"
gasped Ellendine, ignoring the lassitude brought on by triggering the ring.
"Sweep them away, quickly, before they thaw!"
She brushed the rigid things from her garments and armor, stomping. Around her, peacemakers followed suit with barely controlled alacrity. The casements of the crazed seedlings popped and cracked beneath her boot heels. She wasn't sure it was necessary. They might already be dead. She'd imprinted one of the 7 rules directly upon them. In Ardine, all things are subject to death.
Amazing, really. She'd wipe the things out of the air just by willing it.
Death had done Ellendine's bidding. It boded well for when she'd need that power to extract her sister from the court of sleep. The queen's gaze swirled past the white zone of dead invaders, and her flicker of exhilaration blew out. Except in the relatively small zone around her, the seedlings had found purchase everywhere. They were surrounded. Cray scurriers were already shrugging out of discarded skins of bark, feathers, grass, moss, rabbits, and from the skins of the few men who'd tried to get away. An army of strangers was popping up all around them, more than she ever would have thought possible. She and her detail had escaped instant death, but it wouldn't matter in another minute as the newborn Cray converged.
"I'm sorry, my queen," murmured Navarre, the first protector knew the score as well as she.
"As am I, dearest friend." Fear, heady and fierce, tasted like acid in her throat. A sea of monsters besieged them, roaring, slashing, spinning webs, and snapping their pincers. They twirled and surged like the surface of Oceanus, or, Ellendine realized, like dancers conveying the essence of strange itself, twisting and repeating patterns beyond knowing. A Cray along the front reared up, its carapace green and glistening as a favorite candy sold by Hazurium street vendors, and gave voice to a trumpeting challenge that curdled the air. The sound was like nothing Ellendine had ever heard or imagined. But the pincered army remained outside the line of dead seedlings. Why?
"Listen," she said, hardly a whisper. "Listen to me."
She tried again, her voice louder as she pointed.
"See, they fear to cross the line described by death, and for good reason. Form up. We're not dead. Far from it. To me!"
The Cray didn't know the boundary meant nothing. The effect she'd generated with the ring was long gone. Given how tired snatching at death's mantle had made her, she couldn't repeat the effect any time soon. But she forced herself to stand tall, to look confident, to be their queen. Soldiers' eyes were fixed on Ellendine like she was an oasis in the desert. They wanted to believe survival was possible. They just needed a reason. All she had to do was provide one. Simple. And in turn, her dismay lessened as their anxiety fell away. People are eager to find hope, including her. The soldiers formed the lines and defensive groupings that had been drilled into them, creating a defensive circle facing outward. They were trained by Hazarium's finest. "The shells are moving." Navarre's ears flicked sideways. It didn't need saying, of course. Everyone could see it. A handful of Cray among the thousands advanced on the boundary, and more lined up behind them. They weren't in a hurry. They came on, stiff and steady, pincers held ready before them, eye stalks on Ellendine. Lines of webbing flapped over their heads, strands that could cut through the 7 laws like knives before they finally burned away. She wondered how many web strands the army of Cray could spin.
Could such a large force cocoon the entire capital city in their gauzy strands and steal it away into the strange? Imagining it made her feel sick. She sucked in a long breath. The battlefield was no place for distraction, her mother always said. It was for killing. Ashur's ready, she yelled, lifting her palms to the sky.
The soldiers around her lifted their battle staves, sigils snapping with deadly soulmancy. The advancing Kray expletory party didn't falter or lose a step.
They're not scared, muttered a woman with an Ashur raised before discharge.
More's the pity, thought Ellendine. A human or Keflum company would flinch at walking into the sights of 20-some battle staffs. But the Kray didn't think like humans. They were of the strange.
Fire! Commanded Navarre.
Ruin Ashur spit death spells into the advancing horde with a sound like thunder. Kray carapaces shattered, ooze sprayed, and several gaps appeared in their line, here and there, but more advanced, trampling their fallen kin. Some of the replacements were noticeably larger than the fallen scurriers who'd advanced in the first rank. Ellendine frowned. An Ashur sipped vitality from its wielder's soul. But in the face of the advancing sea of enemies, Peacemaker's strength would give out first. The shells had them outnumbered 50-1. She called, "Conserve your strength! Choose your targets!" Navarre pointed, directing her attention to the side. A particularly massive specimen trundled into view, a Kray the size of a small house. Frightened cries sounded around her. Ashur beams caught and sparked on the monster's carapace. It stumbled in the face of the onslaught, but came on.
"Maker, preserve us," she prayed, not for the first time.
As if the Maker had ever heard or responded to a single entreaty in the history of Ardeen. She half believed stories about the Maker were just that, tales for children and credulous adults. Then again, she had death. The heirloom ring was supposedly the Maker's gift to the first of her line. If she didn't believe in the myth of the Maker, why was she here with one of his implements? Why make for the moon door and attempt to petition the Court of Sleep if she didn't believe the Maker made it? The Ring of Death was tied to the Maker. A Maker who might have returned, given the ring's newfound strength. Maybe all that was required was a petition of a different sort, a prayer from a believer willing to take a chance on a vanished god. If he could answer anyone, why not the descendant of one of his ancient incarnations?
"Maker!" she screamed,
ring held before her. The behemoth Kray lumbered closer. More Ashur beams licked it, but their effect seemed less telling each moment.
"Maker, hear me. I am Queen Ellendine of Azurium, and I pray for your aid. If you care at all for what you've wrought, now is the time to intervene. If you've returned, show it. Help me."
The ring warmed on her finger. A bolt of pale light sparked into the sky like a flare, rising so high that it must have passed out of Ardeen and into the strange beyond. She gasped. The peacemakers stopped fighting and the Kray paused. Even the big one hesitated, its eye stalks bending upward to take in the glowing trail. A handful of seconds trickled past. One of the peacemakers pointed skyward.
"There!" he yelled.
A creature soared overhead, leaving a streak of fire behind. It was like a lion wearing a metallic human mask, with eagle-like wings scratching the sky.
A Dlama! They were rarely seen, and everyone who saw them counted it as a good omen.
The Dlama winged closer, revealing its rider. Black armor, limed with glowing red designs, covered the rider like a bulwark.
"Can it be?" yelled Navarre. "The Maker?"
Ellendine's breath caught. The Dlama raced just above the snapping pincers of the shells,
The creatures jostled each other as they leaped and sprayed webbing at the interloper, but the flyer moved too quickly for projected strands to catch it. The rider leaped from the saddle when the Dlama was still dozens of yards away. The Dlama flew on up, but the dismounted rider fell into the circle where Elendine stood. The ground shook, and earth sprayed up in a cloud where he touched down. Peacemakers backed away from the newcomer, who remained as he had landed, down on one knee, in the center of the crater of his own making. The Kray were agitated, but didn't resume their attack. Elendine swallowed. She'd prayed to the Maker, and he'd come. Builder of Ardeen was before her. Unbelievable. His armored form hinted that he was man, not a Kephlum, as some thought he must be. She moved closer. "Thank you," she said, her voice hoarse, "for answering." The figure finally rose. The helm covering the Maker's face was bestial and horned, save for the scarlet lines that glowed almost like fiery tears from his eyes, matching the flame burning on his staff, which he held in one hand. She'd never seen a likeness of the Maker before, but if she tried to guess how he might have looked, this wasn't it. "Hello, Queen Elendine," came a male voice, normal as anything. "I'm here to help." He turned to face the swarm of Kray. Tired of waiting, they surged forward again. Ashers came up to shoulders, burning a new volley of webbing to cinders before most of the lines could reach the defenders. A few still got through. Cords touched the shoulders, the hands, and the boots of the queen's detail. Victims screamed in unbelieving pain. Louder yet came the Maker's roar as he raised his massive staff of black and red iron that burned. He dashed straight past the peacemakers into the advancing Kray towards the behemoth. Trying not to think about what she was doing, she raised her own sword and charged down the lane the Maker had created with his passage. "For Hazurium!" she screamed. She slashed a few Kray as she ran, but those closest to the Maker's path were mostly shattered and dissolving. Ahead of her, he waved the massive stave around as if it weighed nothing, impressive but nothing compared to what he did next. The Maker split into more than a dozen duplicates. The newcomers flowed from him like water from a tap, each one armored in red or in green, none black like the Maker. In seconds, a small army of at least 30 Makers swept out through the sea of Kray, fighting, killing, but also falling and dying and crying out in their own voices of pain. The Maker stopped spawning copies when he'd reached the behemoth. Battle was joined. Elendina counted herself an able swordswoman, especially given the power in her relic blade. But the man before her knew warfare like she knew the back of her own hand. Better. It was nothing short of magic. She realized she'd stopped fighting. She closed her mouth and renewed her advance. As she did, the behemoth lashed out. The Maker grunted as he deflected a pincer the size of a dragon's wing on his burning staff. He spun away to smash an elbow into a normal-sized Kray that slunk up behind. The thing's shell crunched through like a pastry. "Watch out!" Elendine yelled, as the behemoth's second pincer slammed down. He almost avoided it, rolling up and away through the air like an acrobat on a wire. Given his armor, such a move was a miracle in its own right, but not miraculous enough. The pincer clipped him with a sound like a hammer to the blacksmith's anvil. The Maker went down. Elendine snapped out, "Rinse one, dear," without thought, severing the pincer as it descended on the fallen warrior. Then the Maker was up again, fighting. Together over the course of a hard-fought minute, they brought the behemoth down. "Thank you for that," the Maker offered, ever so slightly out of breath. She said, "I doubt you required it," then wished she'd stayed quiet. Around them, the Kray were dying.
or peacemakers, bolstered by the might of the Maker's red and green-hued avatars, were winning the day. Losses were steep, but it seemed clear the Kray would be defeated. The few remaining just didn't realize it yet. It wasn't in their nature to retreat. "So," she ventured, trying to read the Maker's visage, looking for eyes behind that armored helm to focus on. "Should I call you Maker?" The head jerked to regard her. Then laughter echoed from the suit. Finally he said,
You might indeed. And you have my thanks, truly. That thing might have actually had my ticket if you hadn't distracted it. You're quite the warrior, Queen Elendine.
You're too generous. He shrugged, his armored shoulders magnifying the movement.
Could be, but enough. Do you have the ring? I need it, if we're going to fix all this. Peace? Death.
Elendine nodded and lifted her hand. A feeling of lightness filled her up. She was in the presence of the Maker. He was real. He would fix things. He would help her get her sister back.
There it is, said the Maker, his voice gleeful.
Elendine said, With this, I could enter the Court of Sleep. My sister died. It wasn't right. With peace, I mean, with death, and you returned. Elendine trailed off. She was babbling, not making it clear that she wanted the Maker to return Flora to life. But the Maker said, Of course, and I mean to help you. No reward is too much to ask.
Resurrection is well within my power.
Elendine blinked, hardly daring to believe her ears.
But first, he continued, you've got to return your ring to its full power. With my return, a portion of its strength is back, but not all it once possessed.
Not enough for your sister, I think, until we repair it, so lend it to me. His mouth quirked as he continued, I'll take it to the Maker's hall, fix it up there, then bring it back here.
She was going to see her sister again. Joy washed away her fear and pain and made her impulsive. Elendine removed the metallic band and dropped it into the Maker's gauntleted hand.
The Maker laughed. Something in his tone seemed off.
Elendine added, As you know, the ring was given to the first of my line by you, of course.
She laughed, feeling stupid, but she pressed on. The ring has passed from mother to daughter in an unbroken chain since then.
Maybe I should—
Don't worry, the Maker said as he waved at something high overhead. The Dlama. It descended as the conflict burned out. Only a couple of the Maker's doubles remained, and they, along with Elendine's peacemakers, seemed intent on pursuing a last of the Kray that, too late, tried to escape into the underbrush of the clearing's edges. The rush of air pushed Elendine back a half a step as the Dlama sat down. The great metallic mask hiding the creature's face was red and savage.
Bestial, almost. Not a look she would have guessed for the Maker's mount.
The armored figure vaulted into the saddle. Events were rushing out of her control.
Wait, said Elendine. You said you'd bring it back here. Would you prefer to return it to me at my palace in Hazurium? I mean, when should I expect you?
Actually, Queen Elendine, I have bad news. I won't be returning the ring to you, ever.
What? But my sister, you said—
Yes. Well, I lied, and not just once. I'm sorry, but I'm not the Maker. Not the original, anyhow. Though the job has recently opened up, and I'm stepping in.
Elendine gasped.
Who are you, then?
You know me.
People around these parts call me the Betrayer. I prefer incarnation of war, or just war, if you're going to be informal. Your great-great-great-grandmother called me Jason. He laughed. None of that matters anymore. I've got your ring. Once I get a couple of others, I'll have what I need to break into the Maker's Hall and claim Carter's mantle for my own. Vajrama leaped into the sky, bearing away the betrayer, with Elendine's last hope clutched in his thieving hand. Chapter 17 Namer Carter Morrison. A furnace-bright point of fire raged in the sky, forcing me to squint into the glare and look away. Glass stretched away in every direction, like God's own solar oven. The heat tasted like burnt sand. My sweat was already drying. Not good. On the other hand, when I let my fingers run across my upper chest, they felt no salty red wetness or gaping hole. All evidence of the gunshot wound was gone.
Holy shit, I'm gonna live.
The emptiness swallowed my shout. The glass didn't care. If anything, it seemed even warmer than before. That and a strange lethargy clung to me, a feeling of hollowness in my belly that refused to depart despite the lack of wound. Was I going to live? An inventory of my resources revealed a pale gray tunic under a blue coat. Cuneiform runes, vaguely familiar, stitched the coat's hem. Where had I seen those designs before? My boots were impressively comfortable, maybe because of their leather soles. A pack hung off my shoulder. A few pouches, a satchel, and a bulging water skin were clipped to my belt. I pulled the water skin's cork and sniffed. It smelled a bit leathery and wasn't the least bit cold. Beggars couldn't be choosers. Not hydrating in this heat would see me dead within an hour, tops. Pressing my lips to the skin's mouth, I sucked down a gulp. My mom used to set out pitchers of ice water for my friends and me in the backyard while we played basketball. That water had nothing on this. Yes, it was warm, but it washed away the taste of burnt sand in a lukewarm deluge. It promised life, and the hollowness in my stomach retreated. Enough water filled the skin to last at least a few hours in this unrelenting glare. Maybe long enough to see me somewhere less bright and oven-like. The water from the skin revived me and my brain, too. How could I have forgotten the runes on my tunic? I commissioned the creation of an alphabet for Ardeen, Land of the Curse, years ago. Roughly the symbols on my clothing read, One Who Names, or maybe One Who Makes. With that recognition, I also knew that the flat, reflective plain all around me was the glass desert, a part of Ardeen called Quambus. I was in Ardeen, Land of the Curse. It was all fucking real. Intellectually, knowing a place existed was one thing, seeing the sky go on forever and feeling the searing heat of an actual desert was another. It made me a bit dizzy. Or was it sunstroke? I experimentally stamped on the glass with my leather soles. It shimmered with vibration, sending a hard shock back up through my heel and calf. Rubbing the back of my hand across my lips felt entirely authentic. The sweat forming in my armpits and on my brow were just as prolific as if I had been sitting in the middle of Death Valley in California. And why not? Anything could be emulated if nearly unlimited processing power was on tap, which was what the dark energy network provided. I had no recollection of ever coming here before. Well, no, that wasn't entirely true. Something. Memory tickled my brain. I had visited Ardeen after creating it. And when I did, I gained root access. I was Ardeen's designer. I'd know where all the code was buried, so to speak. So I'd stepped into the ready-made role of Ardeen's maker and offered to incarnate my friends the same way if they wanted. They did. Why not? We'd been trapped. Alice, Mel, Jason, Sanders, and I had become like gods, thanks to me. Jason, chose the incarnation of war. Alice, the incarnation of silence. Sanders, lore. And Mel considered the incarnation of desire, but finally settled on death. Then, a bead of sweat rolled off my eyebrow and stung my eyes. The insane recollection of handing out divine roles to my friends skittered away. Shit! I tried to dredge it up again. It shattered in my mental grasp like a soap bubble, like a dream facing daylight. Had it been real at all? If I was hallucinating from the warmth already, it wasn't a good sign. Another sip from the water skin didn't help. I squinted into the glare reflecting from the glass stretching away to all horizons. The sun wasn't directly overhead yet, or I'd probably already be dried out as a prune. Splintery cracks and occasional glass dust dunes interrupted an otherwise smooth surface. A deep scratch passed not more than a few dozen feet from me, stretching away in both directions as far as I could see. "Oh, wow," I muttered, imagining the massive skate that had probably made the furrow. When Ardeen had been all code and art orders for animators, glass pirates had been conceived. They sailed on ships with iron skates instead of keels. The long groove in the glass might well have been laid down with just such a skate. If I were lucky, maybe another glass pirate would sail by and offer me a lift to some place with more shade. If I was unlucky, one would try to run me over for sport or capture me so they could sell me as a slave in Columbus. Unless I could help myself first. Closing my eyes, I renewed my effort to recover the memory of my previous visit. According to Michael Bradley, I'd visited him after my supposed funeral, wearing some outlandish black outfit claiming that I had become the Maker. Why couldn't I remember more? I concentrated. Fresh images surfaced, but they were fogged and broken. Sort of like looking through the pocked, shattered surface of the glass desert itself to the bedrock beneath. Otherworldly scenes spun past. The seven sentinels walking, Crave pouring through a breach in the world, and the incarnation of war, with Jason's grinning face becoming a numberless army to defend Ardeen. But nothing else. It was as if most of my mind had been cut away. Or as if it hadn't really happened to me at all. Nothing else Ardeen related flickered in the recesses of my brain. Time to face facts. Except for a few random impressions, I was missing crucial memories of my previous time in Ardeen. There was nothing I could do about that, at least not immediately. On the other hand, I perfectly recalled waking up in the Seattle storage base. And everything after that, including the events at the BDR office. It'd be hard to forget a gunman putting a bullet through me. And Jason showing up with a hate-on for me that frankly seemed insane. His time here had obviously unbalanced him. The worm he injected onto the Internet was supposedly bursting with schematics for a quantum computer chip capable of pinging the Strange. Why would he do that? It was an insane risk for him to take. I'd been too shot to ask him why at the time, and then he'd slip back to Ardeen. I tried to follow using his ring and save my life in the process. The ring. Sometimes I'm such an idiot. Jason had hinted it was the Ring of Desire. Once I figured out how to channel its power, where was it? It had been the catalyst for flipping across the boundary into Ardeen, but it wasn't on my finger. Nor was it in any of the pouches, pockets, or hidden compartments of my clothing, I was forced to admit after a thorough search. The artifact hadn't made the trip back with me. Well, shit. Picking a direction along the furrow in the glass, I began walking. The boots would protect my feet from burning,
though care would still be required if I was going to travel across the desert. Stray splinters could cut the boots and my feet within to shreds. After a few hundred yards, I shrugged out of my blue coat and hung it over one arm. If anything, the heat was even more oppressive without the coat to block it. The weakness was back, and growing dizziness made each step more of a risk than the last, comfortable leather soles or not. The heat was too much. I needed an edge, and quick. If you have anything of the Maker in you, I told my reflection in the smooth surface between my feet, it's time to wake up. My reflection looked back at me stupidly. My gaze shifted to the runes on my coat. I spoke the symbols aloud. One who names. What did that mean? The phrase had the sound of a title. Maybe it was my title. We'd added a bit of true name magic into some of the subsystems of Ardine during the beta. Did this fully realized version of our make-believe land have anything like that? My gaze drifted to a crater-like blemish in the glass not far from the groove I'd been following. Lying in many pieces in the crater was what might have been a broken stone sculpture. I couldn't be sure. I wondered if it had fallen from the sky. Kicking through the pieces, I found a few other bits of splintered wood, a rusted sword blade, some shattered ceramic that might have been part of a large tankard, and a metal sphere that must have been a cannonball. Did glass pirates have cannons? I couldn't remember. But evidence argued yes. That, along with what was obviously a belaying pin, hinted the entire mass had fallen from a glass pirate ship. I fished the cannonball from the jumble. It was silvery, gray, and not especially large, just big enough to fit in my palm, rough and sun-warmed. Rust patches specked the sphere, and it wasn't perfectly round, but it was solid. The discoloration and irregular shape almost made the thing look like a metal skull. I addressed it. "What's your name?" I felt only slightly foolish when it didn't answer, mainly because I sensed it had no name to give me. If it was to help, it needed a voice. I decided a name would help wake it, and not any old name, I felt, with a thrill of certainty. A name that only I could give. Jesher. I named the metallic ball, though I didn't quite know why. It just seemed right. More words bubbled up. Jesher is your name. I invest you with the gift of sight and knowledge. Wake from sleep and greet your Maker. I didn't quite drop it when the iron sphere vibrated in my hand and a voice answered, Jesher is my name. I greet you, Maker. But it was a close thing. I did sort of juggle it. Holy shit, I'd made a talking cannonball. I just didn't have the first clue how I'd done it. Best not look a gift horse in the mouth too early, though. Surprise made me forget what I'd taken as heatstroke symptoms. What can you tell me? I said, recalling that I'd promised the inert thing the gift of sight and knowledge. Many things, Jesher replied. All things are reflected here in the glass. What do you want to know? The voice was a whisper, and the vibration was creepy. I decided to ask my most pressing question rather than directions to the nearest shade. If the gift for Gab bestowed was only temporary, I might only have one shot at finding Jason. Tell me where I can find war. It whispered.
War is on the move. He returned to Ardine just this day, like you.
Oh, I said. Of course I'd already known that. The sphere might merely be reflecting my own knowledge back. He returned in another's guise, pretending to be one greater than he. What the hell did that mean? A soft hiss in the distance sounded, but I tuned it out. Jesher, I ventured. Can you tell me where Jason is now? His mind is concealed from me. Well, crap. What else can you do? Only what your naming bequeathed me. All right, so you know stuff. You have sight and knowledge. How wide is your knowledge?
Test me and see, came its whispered reply like a dare. A new thought struck me. I said, before Ardeen, there was only a starting grid. The starting grid had, controls.
Can you show me similar controls in Ardeen?
No, said Jusher.
I frowned. The hiss I'd noticed earlier was louder now and had gained a scratchy undertone, but I wasn't going to let it distract me. I asked, I once assumed the mantle of the Maker of Ardeen. Do you know how I managed that?
No.
Jusher was an artifact of few words. Actually, the less an inanimate object spoke, probably the better. Especially something created by me in what was essentially a stab in the dark. Who knew what kind of dangerous shit I'd stirred up? My hair was damp with sweat from the heat as I scratched it. Jusher, I addressed the metallic lump again. As your namer, I command your first allegiance. Is that clear? You answer only to me. The seer vibrated in my grip before it replied.
I will not betray you to the betrayer, Jason Cole.
That had come oddly out of the blue. Moreover, the title bequeathed on Jason was like a fist to the gut. It was familiar, but I couldn't quite remember why. The betrayer. Jason's name here in Ardeen is War, isn't it? What's your... The sound of the scratchy hiss I'd been hearing for a while finally grew so loud that I could no longer ignore it. I turned. A ship, under full sail, supported by a single massive iron blade beneath it, was bearing down on me across the glass desert. I goggled. It sped toward me without slowing. When I threw myself out of its way, it was almost too late. The blade narrowly missed cutting me in half.
Glass pirates! I should have been watching for them.
I designed the fuckers to be aggressive. I was following the tracks of one, for God's sake. Except I hadn't actually expected my own creation to manifest as something real, then try to kill me, because I'm dumb. I'd have to cure myself of that quick if I wanted to live out the rest of the day. The ship skated clear of my rolling body. Questioning shouts became excited cries of discovery and joy as pirates at the rear of the craft spied me regaining my feet. The hunt was on, and I was the prey. I considered my options. The pirate ship was executing a wide turn back towards me, its sails snapping to tack with the wind. Fresh shouts of delight echoed sharply off the glass surface. The figures on the ship's prow wore brightly mismatched finery. I spotted a couple of eye patches and limb prosthetics and an overabundance of weapons. In other words, they looked like pirates. Most were human, but not all. One had a head like a jackal's. I noticed him because he screamed, "Take him alive! The Citadel's paying double for fresh slaves!" In Ardeen, humans with jackal heads could only be one thing, Kephlim. Kephlim were the angelic servitor race I'd imagined as having once served the various incarnations. This one had obviously shed every ounce of its angelic history. Jusher observed,
"They mean you no good."
I resisted the urge to respond sarcastically because Jusher was right. The ship was coming at me again. I stuffed my coat and Jusher into the satchel, then bent and retrieved the belaying pin I'd noticed earlier. This time, the craft slowed as it approached. Half a dozen pirates tumbled down ropes, slid over the side, and smashed onto the glass, apparently unconcerned with the blazing warmth. I backed a few steps, but what else could I really do but confront them? It wasn't like I could outrun anyone in this heat. One who dropped onto the glass was a Kephlem I had seen on the ship's prow. When I focused on him, I realized two things. He was actually a she. And I knew her name, despite never having met her before. Siraja. No time to wonder how I could possibly know that, because they sprinted towards me.
Siraja, hold, I yelled. Don't you know who I am?
The Kephlem's head rocked back when I named her, and she slowed. Those behind her did likewise.
No, who are you? Siraja said.
The tips of her ears swiveled forward as her eyes tried to pierce mine. The tiniest glow of light flickered in the air between her tall ears.
How do you know me?
Who cares, said the bulky man at her side. He carried a hammer so large it almost looked ridiculous. Almost.
Besides him and Siraja, three other pirates had come down onto the glass. One was tiny, one was dressed all in red, and the last, a woman with braided hair that seemed to move of its own accord.
I care, Siraja told the hammer wielder, whose name I suddenly realized was Kadir.
Siraja continued.
I told you we can sell this meat at the Citadel of the Harrowing, so, Kadir replied, Dick Spittle.
You're not the captain's favorite anymore, Siraja. I am. And I say we beat this Sark fondler into mash. He's got nice shit. Dibs on his boots.
Before I could offer a reasonable objection, the brute charged me. Without thinking, I yelled, Kadir, stop! Kadir slowed, surprised that I knew him too. But he didn't come to a complete halt. On the other hand, instead of tenderizing my brains, his hammer missed. I took a few practice swings with the belaying pin. The rod whistled satisfying through the sweltering air. Kadir came at me again, but Siraja raised a curved blade and yelled, Kadir, you puck-faced rat, it's not your decision. She hewed at him, not me.
The hammer wielder whirled to deal with the unexpected threat on his flank, which made it easy for me to deflect his swinging hammer with a backhand swing of my rod. The impact jolted my wrist and stung my palm, but it felt good, too.
Real. Kadir screamed to the others. I told you, didn't I say she'd try something? Get her!
The tableau reset. Now Siraja stood at the center of a loose ring of her compatriots, the tiny fellow, the one wearing all red, and the woman with moving hair, plus Kadir, a huge grin stretching his face. I glanced up at the ship, which had stopped moving. A weathered name was visible on the prow, Nightstar. Several more figures stood watching events, with wagers passing between them. None of them were looking at me, but rather at Siraja and her predicament. I wondered if it was time to leave them to it.
Mutiny, growled Siraja, her ears and head glancing around to take in all those who minister.
Oh, come on, drawled the woman whose hair moved. Her name, I realized, was Mevish, the Strangler.
Mevish continued, to be mutiny, you'd have to be part of the command structure, and you're not. Not anymore. The woman laughed. A cold voice yelled down from the ship.
Hold!
I glanced up. Another Kephlem had spoken. A male wearing particularly fine clothing and several gold rings piercing his tall ears.
Captain Timon. That was his name.
I knew with easy certainty, despite having never seen him before. Apparently, knowing names was just something I could do here in Ardeen. Perhaps I shouldn't have been surprised. The pirates on the glass gave Captain Timon their complete attention. Timon folded thick arms across his chest, arms supporting grandiose metallic braces.
He said, "Settle this squabble. I don't care how. Except for one thing. If Siraja comes back aboard the Night Star, then Kadir may not. If Kadir returns instead, then Siraja must remain on the glass."
Timon threw a two-finger salute, turned, and strode out of view.
"Well, well, well," said Kadir.
The tiny fellow guffawed. The one wearing all red and Mevish, with the moving hair, both grinned. Saraja said in a cold voice, "You firepeckers have always been against me." Not even her captain had her back. She was alone, which gave me an idea. "Hey, Saraja," I said, "if I help you sort this out, do the same for me? Vouch for me with your, crew." All the pirates looked at me. The one between me and Saraja, Mevish, shifted her position somewhat, so she was no longer bracketed between us. "What can you do?" Saraja asked. Declaring my ability to guess names sounded incredibly lame even to me, so I hefted my heavy belaying pin and adopted a martial position. "I can..." The little guy's hands blurred, and a knife was suddenly protruding from my shoulder. The tiny fucker had thrown it. I screamed and dropped the rod. That was Saraja's cue. She spun, her curved sword extended. The little guy's head spun away from his body. His blood spattered on the glass, painting a zigzagging trail between his slumping form and the rolling lump of meat. My inner voice told me what his name had been, but I promptly forgot it, seeing as how it was no longer relevant. A flurry of swinging pirate blades, iron hooks, and hammers erupted around me. One hand on my shoulder where the knife still protruded, I scrambled backwards. My ability to swing a heavy iron belaying pin meant squat in Ardine, where sorcerers and fantasy heroes walked. I was a fool to think otherwise. Running away seemed the only thing I could do, despite my offer to help Saraja. Except, hold on. I was part of this world now. Hell, I'd made it, at least in a manner of speaking. Shouldn't I be able to partake of the same abilities those heroes blithely employed? If my spotty memories and Bradley's story was any indication, I'd done it once before and become the Maker with a capital M. I should be able to do it again. Except I had no idea how. Yelling Shazam didn't seem to work. Saraja bellowed, jerking my attention back to the fight. Only a few seconds had passed, but already she was bleeding from several cuts. The little knife thrower was down, but Kadir, Mevish, and the guy in red still threatened. She saw my glance and yelled, "What are you waiting for? Help me!" Right. Maybe something like what I'd managed before, when I'd made Kadir hesitate. I focused my attention on him. Kadir was his common name, and everyone knew it. But as I concentrated and pushed deeper, his true name popped into my brain. All his strengths, all his weaknesses, all that he'd ever been was in that hidden name. Indeed, he was hardly more than a shell, acting according to a limited nature. He didn't have the spark of true consciousness. I don't know if that made it a difference or not, but maybe it'd make what I was about to try easier. I pronounced a portion of Kadir's true name. To anyone who heard it other than himself, it was a nonsense word. To Kadir, it was the voice of thundering, burning command. Seeing that I had his attention, I said, "Drop your hammer." The hammer cratered onto the glass. The sound seemed to jolt him out of his daze. He blinked and shook his head, then pointed at me. "He's a soul sorcerer. Forget Saraja. Kill him!" Oops. Kadir grabbed for his hammer, but a residue of my command lingered, preventing him. Saraja engaged the fellow in red before he took more than a step towards me. I lost track of the Keflin when a braid of Mevish's hair lashed towards me, its tip uncannily cobra-like. I ducked, but a second braid grasped me around the ankle and yanked. I fell on my left side. The braid kept pulling, and I slid along the glass, unable to stop myself. Mevish's laughter scratched my ears. I tried to focus on her, searching for her true name as I had Kadir's. I couldn't get my breath, and the heat finally seemed to have soaked into my brain. Her true name eluded me. I needed help. The winding length of animate hair yanked me across the glass. A friction burn seared my ass through the cloth. Before I could more than grasp at that,
Mevis kicked me in the side with the strength of a mule, and I lost track of everything else. Pain blossomed, and I folded sideways, gasping. She kicked me again.
"Ever been strangled?" Mevis asked. "How about drawn and